Hello and welcome to The Change Troubleshooter. This is Nina Dar's podcast. Welcome to a brand new season of The Change Troubleshooter. This second season of the podcast focuses on sustainability, something we all need to focus on a lot more. We kick off the season with this episode, Does Sustainability Start at Home?, where Nina is joined by Zoe Cohen and Bob Barr. Zoe Cohen, Director of Shine Coaching and Consultancy, is a highly experienced master coach who has worked with senior leaders and their teams across every sector in the economy. Zoe has run her successful coaching practice for over 10 years. She has been passionate about sustainability all her life. In 2014, she co-founded and was the volunteer chair of a community energy company for 3 years. She is a carbon literate coach, and her work is expanding into the human, behavioural and psychological aspects of climate change awareness and action. She is also an active member of Extinction Rebellion and dedicates a significant proportion of her time to activism. Bob Barr is a Lyme Parish Councillor and Opposition Leader on Warrington Borough Council. He also chairs Lyme Community Energy. By profession, Bob is an urban and social geographer, specialising in geographic data science and open data. He worked at Manchester University for 30 years, is currently a visiting professor at Liverpool University, and founded the university's spin-out, Manchester Geomatics. He was a member of the Cabinet Office Open Data Group, the Advisory Panel on Public Sector Information, and the Social Exclusion Unit's Better Information Policy Action Team. Bob has a lifelong interest in sustainability issues. As a board member of Helena Housing, a major regional housing association, he championed sustainability on the board and became chairman of Caribou, a not-for-profit sustainable warmth and flood resilience company. Nina uses her home village of Lyme as a case study on how sustainable the place where she lives actually is. Both Zoe and Bob have been committed to a number of local initiatives over the years. But is that enough to make Lyme a sustainable village?
Hello everyone, and welcome to the next episode of season 2 of the Change Troubleshooter podcast. And today's episode is called Does Sustainability Start at Home? And I am so excited to have Bob Barr and Zoe Cohen with me today. Hello, both of you.
Hi.
Hello, hello.
And Bob is an urban and social geographer and also a politician. And Zoe is an exec coach, mother and activist. And I'm so excited about this one because it's all to do with some of the research I started when I finished studying with Cambridge University. And one of the things they sent us away with was go back and look at what's happening on your own doorstep. And so the very first person that I was directed to was Bob. And Bob very kindly opened a whole window of opportunity for me, introducing me to Zoe straight away and then other people. And it became very easy to try and see what was going on. And very enlightening for me, as somebody who has lived in Lyme for about 20 years now and apparently knew nothing about the area that I live in, and especially when it came to sustainability. So our home is Lyme in Cheshire. There's a little map there so that you can all see it. And it is a village and a civil parish in the borough of Warrington. It is represented by a 12-member parish council, of which, Bob, you are on. And Zoe has done a lot of work in that area. And despite the fact we're a village, we have a population of over 12,000 people, which seems extraordinary. So how long have you lived here, Bob?
Ooh, about 37 years now. But again, when I worked in Manchester and worked around the world, I didn't know that much about what was happening in the village. It wasn't until I got into local politics about 20 years ago that I suddenly started realizing how much of an outsider I was. So there's a big commuter population of people with worldwide interests like yourself who need an opportunity to start seeing what's happening on their doorstep.
No, it's embarrassing, really, isn't it, that we do that? We travel everywhere and then don't know where we live. Zoe, how long have you been in them?
Similar-ish to you, Nina, about 19 to 20 years, about that. I understand what the perspective you're saying, because my husband's always travelled around for work. I've travelled around the country for work, not quite as much as him. So we both travelled, but I've always had a foot in the local community and I've been involved in community volunteer stuff all my life, really. My mum worked in the charity sector for a bit. So I was just brought up doing that, as well as working around the place. Whereas my husband, if he wasn't married to me, he'd have no clue what was going on.
So is Lyme a sustainable village? That's the first question.
That's a really simple one to answer. No, it's not. Nowhere near.
Yeah, when you look at this list of things here, you would think that we were doing some good stuff.
But initiatives aren't sustainability, Nina. There's a million, initiatives and groups and good stuff and good people doing good things is not the same thing as 12,000 people living in a sustainable way, because we're a million miles away from that.
Yeah.
No, I think Zoe's quite right. One of the things that's interesting is how easy it is to get people to virtue signal their commitment to sustainability. What's much harder is to get them to actually change their own behaviours, and particularly change their own behaviours radically, which is what Zoe is asking for.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's what we're trying to touch on in this podcast as well. It's really the difference between seeing something and then saying, oh, look, we have a low carbon limb. That must be a good sign that we're doing something well, when actually, even in my own house, I still just have gas central heating like everybody else. And, not really thinking about doing anything about that. But we could, couldn't we?
Yeah. And I just, as much as I have a huge regard and love and respect for you, Bob, I just want to challenge something you said there in terms of the language. The things that Zoe wants you to change, it's not me saying, well, I do want people to, I'd love people to, but I haven't got a magic wand. But actually, as hopefully this conversation will explore, these are the whole range of changes that we have to make to our lives. We have no choice if we want to have a future. So it's not me saying it's the science, effectively. We have to stop emitting. We have to stop using fossil fuels. We have to change the way we live. We have to change the way we use land, what we eat. We've got no choice if we want to have a future.
I agree. All of that is true. But the real issue is, how do you actually lead people along? Because it's quite easy to get people to agree with that. And I will agree with that. But I've not changed my gas central heating. I have a gas guzzler of a car. There's a whole set of unsustainable things that I do and I aspire to do. And I think that if I'm keen on it, and I've spent a lot of my time volunteering on sustainability issues of various sorts, if even I will not go to the absolute extremes, and I think Zoe has to also ask herself, she will go to greater extremes than the rest of us, but nevertheless, there are limits to the extent to which she'll change hers and her family's lifestyle.
And note your hand there, Zoe, but let me take you into where the two of you started, which was such a long time ago, really. We all know this conversation about sustainability, climate change, started a long time ago. It's very much in our minds at the moment because it's become part of the mass conversation. But actually, we were encouraged to do things way back. And here, Low Carbon Lyme started in late 2008, 2009. And when I look at what that was set up to do, to work with all areas of the Lyme community to address the challenges of climate change, reduce carbon emissions. In doing this, we will also reduce our reliance on fossil fuel and save money. Absolutely fantastic at a time when it wasn't part of the big conversation. So what did the two of you do? How did you get people involved in this?
The person I really want to name check here, you should get credit for the initiating Low Carbon Lyme, was the incredible Richard Pearce, who if local people are listening to this, that some of them will know Richard, he's just an amazing and lovely and inspiring lovely guy. So I think he and if for those people who might know this stuff, back to 2008 was the year the Climate Change Act came in. There was, amongst some of the community and some of the population, some of the politicians, in the sort of mid to late noughties, whatever you call them, there was a wave of awareness. And there was the campaign for the Climate Change Act called the Big Ask, and it took 3 years of grassroots mobilisation to get the Climate Change Act passed by the Labour government then, which was at its time the leading piece of climate legislation globally, because it put climate emissions targets into legislation, binding legislation, and no other government, I don't think, at the time had done that. So then we were relatively world leading. And then, of course, the political scene changed and we went backwards decades. But I think, you know, we did all sorts of things in Low Carbon Lim. We did events, we did websites, and I say we as in the collective of those involved, because there were other, Richard, Bob and myself, but also a swathe of other people that, you know, too numerous to mention by name, but credit to all of them. We all put effort into running awareness events, bills where people could go around the village and bag to people's houses and see the things that they'd done, like solar panels or air source heat pumps or whatever. We did all sorts of things. We did energy efficiency grants, advice, lots of things. But it was always involving relatively small numbers of people, sometimes hundreds of people. We got hundreds of people to our events. We put huge effort in. But my heart of heart always knew, Nina, always knew we were scratching the surface, and we were never getting more than, oh, I don't know what, 5% of the Lim population, adult population engaged.
And I'm hiding that question there, out of the population of 12,350, how many people got involved?
Yeah, and it's probably, we probably, you know, adult population, is that probably what, 9,000? We probably got, I don't know, 5% of the adult population with a sort of brand awareness, as it were, which, you know, for a group of volunteers with no money, and we did get a fairly good brand awareness amongst people like the parish council, the borough council, and some of the stakeholder groups and things. But it takes a huge amount of energy for a small group of people. To be totally honest, cutting a long story short, what the first few weeks of this pandemic last year and the lockdown viscerally taught me, which my body knew, but I didn't want to accept, was that until we were made to change, we were never going to. Something had to make us change. Mother Nature had to kick us, and she's given us a loving kick from her sick bed because she is poorly. She is really poorly, and she has to kick us lovingly to wake up and to act. That she can't kick many more times till she dies, but that's what she's doing. And we have to have a kick to change, because good-meaning people trying to talk to 5% of the population is never, ever, and was never going to achieve what we needed to achieve. And that's where I speak from. I'm afraid it's a bit brutal, but that's my honest truth.
I mean, I think Zoe is right. And I think the other thing that is kicking us is that this is our last chance. If we don't do it now, it's not going to happen. There's going to be irreparable damage to the planet. But actually, the history of this goes back a lot further. I was an undergraduate in the very early 1970s when the Club of Rome report came out on the limits to growth. And at that stage, the ecological disaster was big news. Paul Ehrlich was talking about population disasters. I then started my career at the University of Manchester, teaching in the extramural department, teaching people from outside the university. And we put on lots of courses about sustainability. I remember discussing with science colleagues of mine household energy and household carbon budgets. And this was late 70s, very early 1980s. Yet somehow the great growth era post 79 and the complete delusion of a growth economy after 79 meant all of this went away until climate change came back onto the agenda at the turn of the century. So we were given our warnings 50 years ago and we ignored them. And then what Zoe's just described is not the second phase, because it goes in many phases, but is the phase where the science suddenly started coming up with the evidence that their predictions from the 1970s were largely right. And you can actually see physical change. One of the things that's interesting about Storm Christoph just the other week is that suddenly people all around the village have realised that flooding in Lim is going to become a routine matter which is beyond the capacity of politicians or engineers to solve. And the only answer to that is to change our behaviour and change the behaviour of other citizens.
Absolutely. Mm. And there are so many. The recent floods in our local area has got to be one thing that brings everyone together. And I've seen, Zoe, that you have started mentioning to people about having a hedge fund, clever use of words, which is more about looking at the hedgerows and what we're doing with the natural drainage that should be around the farmers' fields, which when you go walking around them, which everyone must be doing at the moment, you actually see for yourself why areas are flooded. You don't need to be a scientist. You can see that the drainage areas have been clogged up, the grids are clogged up, we're not taking care of where the trees have been planted anymore. Lots of trees in our local area are being cut down, and you do wonder whether this is part of a plan where people are looking at the big picture. And for somebody like I am a big picture person, and so when I've been doing this research, that is the main thing that I've been thinking all the time. How is this being linked together? And when we talk about the fact that everything is a system approach, and where there is an action, there will be a reaction, and there are consequences everywhere. And it feels like, but I am way too ignorant to know this for sure, but it feels like what we suffer in Lyme is a lack of one plan that brings all this together. Go on, Zoe, tell me.
No, I don't think you're ignorant or whatever the word is you used at all. I think your intuition and gut feel is absolutely right, because what you're describing is a parallel and an echo of what we have nationally. There is no cross-cutting strategy in government, to my knowledge. If it's treating it at all, it's treating it in a completely siloed way. There's no real leadership from the top. You know, Alok Sharma, the COP lead, he's only just been given it to do full time. Before, he was doing it on the side of his desk whilst he did his business job and stuff. There's individual departments in government, a lot of them have got no clue about their net zero plans. There is no cross-government approach. And I think that's echoed. I mean, you know, Bob, please tell me different, but to be honest, I think that's echoed throughout the whole country. It's not embedded, it's not taken seriously enough. And to sort of go with the mantra that's written on my heart is, you know, tell the truth, and B, act like the truth is real. And there's almost no one in this country that's acting like the truth is real.
Yes, I'd agree with that to some extent, but I think that the scale of intervention that's required is that national scale, and it has to go down to the local. I disagree slightly with Nina about issues in Lyme. Actually, fewer than a dozen houses got inundated in Lyme this time round. 150 houses were warned, and the Environment Agency gave a warning which was too dramatic. We had two threat-to-life warnings in Heatley, and that's why the Borough Council went around knocking on lots of doors. And actually, only about a dozen houses got inundated. And part of that was because the Bolin floodplain did what the Bolin floodplain is meant to do. Likewise, the other area that flooded was Warrington Lane. And we say, oh, it's the farmers who hadn't dealt with the gullies and ditches. Well, actually, that wasn't true. On Warrington Lane, the gullies had been cleared, and the highways engineers, for only a few dozen houses, had replaced the underground gullies, and the residents were keeping those gullies clear. What was happening was the sheer volume of water falling onto those fields, coming down towards the Bridgewater Canal. Nothing could have dealt with that. And when I talked to the residents, they didn't blame the council, they didn't blame the farmers, they simply accepted that this was an inevitable result of climate change, and suddenly they've got to live with the fact that their houses are vulnerable. So I was saying it's because the gullies weren't cleared. And the other thing which the council says, which I think is quite right, is if householders went out with their spade or their fork and pushed the leaves down into the gullies so the gullies could take the water, some of the localised flooding would be reduced. The council no longer has the resources to clear every gully and to clear every leaf. So people will not take personal responsibility. They will perfectly happily say, it's somebody else's fault, it's the council's fault.
This is so interesting though, Bob, actually, if I just pick you up on this point, because there's a lot being written about at the moment about how much responsibility is being pushed now to individuals. And I think that is absolutely fine if we start to recognise we do get a breakdown of what your council tax gets spent on, but I don't think people really understand what that means to them on an individual basis. Yeah. So this idea that there isn't enough money to go round, people find that hard to accept because people pay money for things to be done. And I think we are at an age now where people will take responsibility. I think you only have to look at the immense number of volunteers who have come forward to help with the coronavirus work that needs to be done. So people are always willing to volunteer, but they have to know what for and why they're now responsible for it. And this is what I mean about the things coming together in a more systematic way, because we don't always know that. we don't always understand why we should do it. And then a lot of this work is preventative. I agree exactly with what you were saying about the fact that it was probably all overdone. And the response on the day of the floods was amazing, amazing. I mean, even hit the national news, Little Limb again on the national news. So it was amazing. I feel anyway that as a country, this is what we've become. Even professionally, I feel this. We are firefighters. We love to have a problem that we all get stuck in. The preventative side of the work that needs to be done is really lacking. And I suppose that's where I was coming from. Where's the plan that says, we know climate change exists, what are we going to do about it?
Let me come back on that particular one. In 2015, we had the Boxing Day floods, when again, parts of Lyme were flooded. And parts of Lyme were flooded because the Latchford locks couldn't be opened and the sluice gates were blocked up with timber coming down the ship canal. Following that, firstly, talk about citizens' assemblies, all those affected, all the residents affected, joined the flood committee together with the borough council. A 150-page technical report was produced explaining exactly what had happened and exactly what needed to be done about it. And the citizens working together with the Borough Council, with the Environment Agency and with Peel Holdings, who I'm not normally a great fan of, actually put that plan into action. And this time round, the canal did not overspill. Unfortunately, the Bolin overspilled. And that was simply because the clear volume of water coming down from the Pennines was beyond anything that could have been done. People say, oh, we must build embankments along the whole length of the Bolin. I'm sorry, that's not going to happen. So I think that very often, and it's not so much politicians, I think it's hardworking and very well technically trained officers are given a tough rap for not having done things that they have done, and they've done their best, and they've applied their expertise. But getting the citizen involved, I think, is a key part. There has to be a partnership. You can't be passing the buck. The council can't pass the buck to citizens. Citizens can't pass the buck to the council. We've got to work together.
Yeah, absolutely. Zoe, do you want to finish us off on that?
Yeah, I mean, I have enormous sympathy for local authorities and all public services. Having my first career was in the NHS, and I've done lots of partnership working with local authorities and stuff. I have enormous sympathy of the financial pressures and, you know, the fact local authority spend has been decimated in the last decade plus by 50% or whatever. So they're just a shell of their former selves in terms of budget. So I have huge, huge sympathy for what's the pressures that they're under and other public services. And obviously the political dynamic of centralisation and stripping money out and all the rest of it that we've seen with the pandemic. I think there's lots of echoes with the pandemic, isn't there? That not doing prevention, not listening, being so hubristic and arrogant that we're so, you know, the exceptionalism and all of that stuff, when a pandemic was, wasn't it the top risk on the Cabinet Office risk register nationally? Yeah. And yet it still wasn't taken seriously. So, you know, oh, it's not going to happen to us or whatever they think. I don't know what they actually think about it, but not taking risk seriously. The idea of the precautionary principle is just nowhere. Yeah. You know, I think what people need to get their heads around is that because we've left this all so long, you know, collectively and of course politicians and corporations have left this so long, that we need to understand that this future is the rest of our lives and the rest of our children's lives. So we have to do mitigation, i.e. reduce emissions and change our lifestyles and land use and nature-based solutions, blah, 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 and adaptation. So we have to mitigate and adapt and engage and change the political dynamic and the citizen engagement and the level of democracy. And so we have to do all of that together, and we have to do it in a sort of, it's a bit of a, might not be a helpful word, but I like the word multi-solving approach. So a really smart systems thinking approach where we think, what are the interventions we can do that actually tick lots of boxes because they're really smart interventions? And if we don't do these things, it's only going to get an awful lot harder because climate and ecological breakdown is a threat multiplier and it makes everything harder.
Yeah, absolutely. And that nicely takes us into the question that I pose here. What happened in Lyme then, when the parish council declared a climate emergency? Because again, I will be very open with my ignorance here. I thought that when people were declaring a climate emergency, it meant that something had happened and there was a significant moment where everyone had said, well, now we know for sure we are affected by climate change. And as a result, of the way we are affected, this is our plan of action. And again, just in the research I've done, it doesn't appear to be that black and white.
No, can I give a, I'm sure Bob will want to come in this because I'm not on the parish council, but just as a bit of context, Nina, and you may well know this, and I don't know if listeners do, that if you look across all local authorities in the UK, something like 70-odd% have declared a climate emergency, and an increasing number of other public bodies like NHS organisations and so on. So most local authorities have declared a climate emergency. That doesn't mean they've done anything about it whatsoever or allocated resources or changed their policies. Some are doing stuff, some are sort of leading relatively, but within the constraints they've got and the way the political system's set up and the limits of national policy, et cetera, I can't think of one that's actually behaving in a way that's sufficiently emergency-like. But, and I don't think there's an awful, to be fair, you know, parish councils have got a limited scope and I think they're trying to do more now, but, you know, we're a miles away from actually behaving as if it's emergency. And I wouldn't blame an individual for that. I just think it's the national mindset.
I agree with Zoe, and having taken the climate emergency motion through the parish council, very easy to get it through the parish council, but the question the councils were asking is, yes, but practically, what can we actually do? And the parish council's annual turnover is less than £200,000, and of that, a quarter goes on our police community support officers. So by the time you've paid a parish clerk, deputy parish clerk, and a small team of environmental wardens who go around emptying the bins, there's precious little money that the parish council can apply to a problem like this. So first thing that the parish council did was audited all its own sustainability issues. So we're looking at ways of making the village hall more sustainable because that's our largest energy user and how we spend money on energy, and that's our contribution to the community. We're looking at tree planting. We've got a meeting coming up with borough officers on finding locations for tree planting in Lym at the end of this week. But these are all absolute drops in the ocean in relation to the real problem. So at the end of the day, I'm afraid I go back to the fact that we're virtue signalling by saying, yes, we've got a climate emergency. When we then examine our conscience as to what we can actually do about it as a parish council, it's a relatively small number of things. And then likewise, Lym Community Energy has funded people to look at things that can be done in the village. And they're finding it really hard to come up with practical schemes of ways we can get the whole village involved that would actually make a difference.
Yeah, part of this series is that I interviewed a small business owner in LA, and I'd done the research about the LA Green Deal Action Plan, and the podcast is him responding to that live in the podcast. I sent him all the information that I'd seen, similar to what I've done in Lym, but I didn't want him to tell me ahead of time whether he knew about this, didn't know about it, was involved in it. And we made that part of the podcast. And it was absolutely fascinating because the LA Green Deal plan is amazing. And they have a neighbourhood kit, which I think could be easily adopted by many areas. It could be adopted by Lynn. I mean, when I was reading through it, I was thinking, we could just have one of these. It makes absolute perfect sense. And yet, of course, Joel, who lives in LA, knew nothing about it. So, you know, it was exactly the same situation as we're talking about. Somebody had done all the work there in saying, this is what we can do. And it ranged from, it really covered every sustainability area that you'd want on there with resources that everybody in the neighbourhood could access and encouragement and support to set up little groups to do lots of things. But it didn't mean it was happening, which is the big thing. And Zoe, you want to come in on this as well?
And I can empathise with this as well, because, you know, I've worked in public services and I've worked in big organisations, that it's quite, and small organisations, it's quite easy to get kind of inward looking. And I'm not saying this is a thing for you, Bob, at all, but I'm saying that it's quite easy to be inward looking and not look at, reach out to what the best practice is elsewhere, whether it's in the UK or internationally. But I mean, there are guidance and examples from other councils of what people are doing. And there's, you know, there was a 2-minute sort of Google search or Ecosia search comes up with a really useful little guidance document from Friends of the Earth on 20 things that parish and town councils can do. And I've shared that with some colleagues. So there is stuff out there. But and I would also say, I'm sure you're both aware of this stuff, you know, the idea of like scope one and two, different scopes of emissions. Like scope one, the ones you're directly in charge on, the ones in your supply chain. And then there's also, well, at least nominally, there's scopes beyond scope three. So scopes four, five and six about your kind of your branding, your advertising, your lobbying. So actually, I think that the bigger influence of a parish council, particularly in a place like Lynn, is beyond its scope three. It's actually the communication and the leadership, the influencing and the lobbying of the councillors and the officers and all of their networks with the wider system. So, you know, influencing local landowners, influencing the borough council, creating bigger partnerships that have impact beyond self and beyond, you know, beyond the scale of Lynn. And I think there's all sorts of things that could be done, and that's would scale up way beyond the village hall. You know, that's just like doing scope one and two, isn't it? Scope one and two is almost always the tiny bit of the emissions, and so it's almost best to invert it and think, okay, we'll put 20% of effort into scope one and two, but we'll put 80% of effort into what is our actual leadership potential here, and let's have a really creative, courageous conversation about what if we really led this like it really mattered. What would that look like? You know, that is a completely different conversation and would take the parish council to a completely different place. But it also means members of the parish council need to be up for having that conversation, and they need to feel sufficiently prepared and passionate about it. And I don't know whether they all are.
And maybe, do you think as well, Bob, before you answer on this, do you need more citizens to get involved? You know, do you need more people like us who are saying, yes, this is what we want, to give you the confidence on the parish council that you are acting on behalf of all the residents?
Unfortunately, absolutely, that's the case. It is interesting how this comes up in casework with a very small number of engaged citizens, and it's where we started off. But in a village of 12,500, the people who really, really, really care about this and are doing something about this, probably fewer than 100.
Yeah.
And most of the rest are concerned about people parking across the end of their drive or people who drop litter and don't pick it up and so on. And actually, sadly, most of the work of the parish council and most of the work of parish councillors is dealing with those mundane issues as well as other distressing bits of casework. So you have a choice. Do you deal with cases that involve real homelessness of people in Lynn, or do you deal with trying to change the world? And actually, you have to balance those two against each other. And my view is you have to do both, but you can't exclusively do one.
No, but this comes back to this system thinking, doesn't it? This is my thing, although, and I get so excited about this because when I hear that, Bob, when I hear you say that, I just think, opportunity, 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 because this is just system thinking, because it's all, even the rubbish, it's all part of the same system. Yeah. And if we did do what Zoe was suggesting, we turned the pyramid and we said, we're starting with the big issue. We know we've got maybe 9,000 people here who I am absolutely sure would get behind this in some way, because they are kind of already doing it, even if they're moaning about the kids at the cross or the rubbish on the floor or the flooding or whatever. But what we need to help the parish council do is put the system down and say, right, this is how it's all connected. And this is how then we could separate things up and know that everybody's working towards the same common goal, which is ultimately saving our planet, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that that's absolutely, you're right. And my politician cogs are ticking whilst you say that.
That's good to hear, Bob. And I think for me, my brain obviously works a little bit similar to yours, Nina. It's big picture and it's systemic. And we've also, if we're going to be just a little bit more kind of even more big picture, or dare I say even spiritual about this, we've got to move beyond the dualistic thinking and the separation that's, you know, the separation that stops us thinking about as homelessness as a separate issue from climate emergency, because actually it's all interconnected. We have to care about each other. It's the same as the pandemic, which is why I'm really passionate as well that the incredible work that's been done locally with the mutual aid scheme, amazing, hundreds of volunteers, and you know, I play a tiny part in that, but there are loads of people who've done tons on it and they're amazing people. it's all interconnected, because caring about each other in the pandemic is no different than caring about the people that get flooded, caring about the next generation who have, trying not to swear, but have absolutely little chance of a long-term future at the moment. You know, kids born today may not make it to adulthood or may not make it to older age. So that's how bad it is. So it's really just about caring about each other. And I would love politicians to speak up about that. And if they don't understand it, I'll gladly give my time for nothing to come and explain it to them. But it is just about caring about each other and then caring about understanding that we're part of nature. So breaking down the dualism, breaking down the divisions between each other as humans, and breaking down the division that we're different from nature. We're carbon-based life forms like everything else on Earth. We're just mammals, and we happen to be quite poorly mammals at the moment. So I just want to break all of those divisions down and get people to understand the truth. We're poorly mammals and we need to look after our planet because that's how we survive. It's that simple. But it's really that simple. And the more people that's, we need to change the language. Changing the language is really important.
Yeah. Bob, do you want to say anything?
I mean, I agree with Zoe's macro picture, but it comes back to the distinction between getting people, you can talk to people one by one and they will accept that. When they go off to the ballot box or when they go and to write to you as disgusted of limb, it's as though you hadn't spoken to them about that issue. And getting rid of this dualism, I think, is absolutely right. But it's the behavioural change that is the challenge, not the words that say, oh, yes, we accept that, Zoe is right. It's actually each person doing something differently as a result of that intervention. Mm. And I think we're quite poor at that. And I think that we're poor at that because actually I think politicians don't lead enough. Politicians look where the crowd is going and follow it or sit themselves at the front of it, which is why you'll see Boris converted into the Green Warrior over the next 12 months. Absolutely no doubt about that. Whether it actually make a big difference is another issue. I was on the board of a major social housing provider for about 10 years. I ran their sustainability company, or I chaired their sustainability company. And what was really sad was, despite the fact that I had overwhelming support from the board, I was undermined by the officers eventually. We produced the first zero carbon building built by, it was a passive house standard building as offices in the community centre. We transformed the way in which we managed green space. And all of that was behind the scenes then undermined by officers who weren't committed to it. And that was really worrying. So even in the boardroom, you'll get this rhetoric. You'll get companies like Siemens signing up to a green agenda. But when you actually go a little bit further, you discover it's not what they're doing behind the scenes.
Mm. Oh, all over. And, you know, really, it's one of the reasons, the main reason I ended up studying last year, because a whole career in change management, and you get to realise that, and especially when you work predominantly with large organisations, your ability to actually change anything is, well, it's tiny, if not impossible. And that is because of politics. And so boardroom politics and politics in our wider world, exactly the same. We have adopted very easily. And I think because of the age that I am, and so Bob, when you were speaking before about the fact that we hit the big time, didn't we? All of a sudden, when I was growing up in the 70s, people still led a fairly humble life, you know, one car for the whole family. I can remember my dad used to drive the car to work. If we wanted it in the school holidays, we had to walk to where he worked to pick up the car so that we could go out for the day. We didn't even think anything of that. And then I remember vividly that everyone started getting second cars. And then not only were people getting second cars, everyone was going abroad on holiday. And this is part of my life. And all of a sudden questioning where all this money was coming from. How did everyone have money? And then doing the work that I was doing, then in change projects, you used to get a change project that lasted for 5 years and a budget that covered for the whole 5 years. Then all of a sudden, we had to report every quarter And we were going, well, it doesn't work like that. You can't get change reported financially every quarter. No, but you have to. We have to, because now we're trying to be a FTSE 100 company and we're trying to do this. And the whole, in my working life, the change has been phenomenal. And I think people don't really take enough time to look at that, look back and think, hang on a minute, we were part of this. Where did all this money come from?
They simply privatised the printing of money. it was as straightforward as that. An awful lot of it isn't like real money, except it's turned into real growth. So, for example, everybody in Lim is sitting on a fortune because the house has gone up in value. Of course the house hasn't gone up in value. What's happened is that the price of land has been allowed to inflate artificially and people have been allowed to extract that money to spend on material goods in order to drive a growth agenda.
Yeah.
1975, we had peak equality. Warrington Newtown was designated around about 1970, and it was designated as being as sustainable a town as possible. Milton Keynes at the same sort of time. We had so much right in the mid-1970s, but we were relatively poor. And unfortunately, we went down the growth direction rather than down the equality and sustainability direction. And we've been going in that direction ever since. And that is the juggernaut, the oil tanker we're trying to turn around.
Correct. Mm. And this quote, Zoe, from you that's on the screen at the moment. And when I read this, when you said, you actually wrote, you can't make people care. I turned that into, can you make people care? But it does seem so, but you genuinely believe that you can't make people care because of the experience that you have had.
It's good to tell me that back to myself in a sense, Nina, because, you know, I keep challenging myself on lots of things, but challenging, do I really believe that? On one level, I do, on one level, I don't, in that I think most people do care. I think one can hold the information in one's head that actually, on one hand, people don't care, on the other hand, they do, and both things are true. So let me explain that. There was the biggest climate survey globally happened within the last few weeks. It was published, wasn't it, a couple of weeks ago, the UN poll of about 1.2 million people globally. And interestingly, UK and Italy, both COP joint hosts, although you never hear about Italy because it's in the UK, but UK and Italy COP26 joint hosts, came out joint top of 81% of the respondents saying they took climate emergency really seriously. I can't remember the wording the question was, but it was basically, do you take climate emergency really seriously and do you think you're really worried about it? 81% of respondents. There was a greater proportion of young people included on purpose, which I think is really good because we really, really need to listen to the voices of the young on this. So that tells me that, you know, if you can put any store on that, and it was a well done large scale survey, 4 out of 5 people really get it and care to some degree in this country, or get it to some degree and really care. So I think people do know and care that there's a problem. And we've got two problems we're pushing against. One is the political economy, that everything comes back to short term, putting bread on the table. And I don't blame a single person on earth for that. Of course, that's the system. So we have to have systemic change. People can't imagine, because it's the water we swim in and the air we breathe, people cannot imagine a different economic model. But there are infinite economic models. The economy is not like gravity. There isn't one version of it and one version of the truth. You could get a room full of economists and ask them, design an economy that won't trash the planet and will support the next 7 generations of humans to thrive. And they will design one. People already have, like Kate Raworth, for example, and Jason Hickel. They've done it. It's doable. No one's listening because the people with power don't want to change. So we need to change the economic model, and we need Citizens Assembly and various many other things to do that. But we also are fighting against human psychology. Our brains are not evolved to deal with slow-moving, huge-scale, very complex threats. Our brains are evolved to deal with short, immediate threats, i.e. competing tribe coming to attack us or large, spiky mammal coming to attack us. You know, that's what we're actually evolved to cope with. We're not evolved to cope with huge, slow-moving, relatively slow-moving, amorphous things like global atmospheric change. That's not what our brains are evolved with. So we're struggling against human psychology, and we're struggling against, even more powerful in a lot of ways, the power dynamic in the political economy. If we can address the political economy and speak to the part of people that really cares, just put something out there. If we had universal basic income and people didn't have to worry about putting bread on the table for their kids, people's ability to care and engage in this agenda would go through the roof. Because there are lots of people who would like to engage, but they get distracted to, I have to put bread on the table. I can't change my job because I have to do this. I can't do this because I've got a mortgage.
Yeah.
We're stuck in the system that's killing us. And if we don't escape it, it just will kill us.
Yeah, and just to take the conversation into this next slide now, because you were both involved in this, the CEE bill. We have got a really neat little video that explains it. But Bob, do you want to explain, you know, it was on our list of things that the Lynn Parish Council had signed up to. So tell us a bit about that.
Well, we've signed up to it. Warrington Borough Council has signed up to it unanimously. This is the Climate and Ecological Emergency Bill, which is a private members bill in Parliament, which has been drafted by scientists and is now backed by around about 100 MPs. Now, that's actually quite disappointing. Not a single Conservative has signed to back it. Our own MP, when he heard that the Parish Council, he's a member of the Parish Council, was going to write him a letter asking him to back the CEE, he said, don't waste your time, I've got 20 reasons why I'm not going to support it. Now, I'm finding a similar reluctance from the leader of Warrington Borough Council, because Warrington Borough Council unanimously voted that he should write to our two MPs asking them to support the CEE bill. We've drafted a letter for him to send to the two MPs, so he didn't even have to send a letter. He said, oh, I don't know what the officers have done, I'll check with them. That was months ago, and actually nothing's happening. So there's a real problem. I think that the CEE bill, you know, is fundamentally an educational exercise, and a really important educational exercise. But the fact that it's only got through to a sixth of the MPs is massively disappointing.
Let's play the video so that everybody listening and watching gets a good understanding of what it is.
This is an emergency, and the CEE bill is really important to help us deal with it. Do you know about it? I'm one of the scientists to help write the bill, and this is what it's about. Part one is about reducing our emissions to keep planetary heating down to 1.5 degrees. This will minimise extreme storms, wildfires, floods, and all the rest of it. Part two is about conserving and restoring ecosystems and soils, protecting wildlife and the places we love, and absorbing lots and lots of carbon into woodlands and vegetation. Both make it clear that if products we import cause emissions in China or deforestation in the Amazon, we'll treat that as our problem and not someone else's. Part three is about how we make the decisions we need. The bill calls for a citizens' assembly to help government and parliament create the strategy to make it happen. People-backed, bold decisions, avoiding party political infighting, where people have a real say in choosing a fair path to a zero carbon society and a thriving natural world. Get your MP to support them. Our future is dependent.
Zoe, do you want to say anything about it?
Yeah, I thought long and hard about the Climate and Ecological Emergency Bill. I decided to be a huge supporter of it. And the reason I had to think long and hard about it is because I don't have an awful lot of faith in the current political system. Sorry, Bob, it's not personal at all. I've got a huge respect for you personally. I don't have a lot of faith in the system. And that's why movements like Extinction Rebellion are so important, because the system is set up and built to be short term. You know, politicians rarely think beyond 2 years if we're lucky, because it's just 2 years in, it's about the next electoral cycle. And we know that that's rubbish when we have to think about big systemic change, which is what's needed for climate and ecology. So this bill is really crucial. And of course, it's only part of the picture, but I do think it's really, really crucial. And it is completely based on the science and the political and social science, which is also important with the Citizens Assembly. So the bit I would kind of pick up when you say, Bob, that it's disappointing that only a sixth of MPs are engaged. Again, maybe it's the shred of optimist in me, and it's not that big a shred actually, but I'd flip it round to say, for a campaign that only really launched properly September 2020, to have got over the course of a pandemic and Christmas and what, to have 100 MPs engaged, I think that's not bad at all on a shoestring. And every party is engaged other than the Conservatives. So I think that's really positive. I think it's brilliant that Lib Dems are signed up as a party, as are a couple of other smaller parties. I think that's really encouraging. And businesses and NGOs are also starting to sign up now. So I think that's encouraging. And also, you know, I'm holding on to the fact that the Climate Change Act came into law through a grassroots movement like this. And so it's been done before, and therefore it can be done again. I think that's probably what I want to just say on that. I think it can be done again, and I think it needs, you know, especially in 2021, it's the year of COP26. It's a really important message to get across during this year to raise this government's ambitions in COP. It's part of that picture, really.
It is. I mean, I love everything that's in the bill, but the thing that was real standout for me was the Citizens Assembly, which I think is such an important initiative. And I think as we move forward, the only way we're going to get more engagement and that behavioural change that you're talking about, Bob, is to really speak to the hearts and minds of every citizen in the country and move them away from this position that they, as an individual, one person, the people, they can't actually do anything. Yeah. And because politics has got to such a degree where even, you know, the people that don't care because they think it's a game, and it's a game that is played with or without them. And young people feel that there should be something new now. A lot of the customs and tradition that we hold on to in Westminster, I don't think help with behaviour change. It's not progressive, it's not moving forward. When you watch Parliament in action, it's quite distressing. You just wonder what age we're actually living in. So for generations now who grow up with technology in their hands, swiping things and getting information in a completely different way, we are just not talking their language anymore. Yeah. Go on, Zoe.
I completely agree, Nina, but you've reminded me of something that I think is really important that I want to get across to listeners of this podcast, that individual change is really important. It's partly because we need lots of lifestyle changes, but on its own, it won't be enough, and it never was enough. And it's part of the greenwashing, gaslighting agenda that corporations and fossil fuel companies have been selling us for decades, that it's our responsibility. Actually, there's something like 70 companies globally that cause most of the emissions. So it is our responsibility as consumers and citizens and parents and adults, and the fact that we're alive now in this last generation, that can make the difference before it's too late. And there are a small number of corporations and regulators and government bodies and politicians who also need to, and media, who majorly need to step up into this space. And we can all play a part in that. So, you know, there are some levers. I mean, people listening to this may know that there's an increasing divestment movement, you know, like pension funds and others divesting out of fossil fuels. That's getting more and more coverage. But there's some really important leverage points in the system, which, as an individual, if you stop eating meat or whatever, which, by the way, it's a really good thing to do, but that won't influence the leverage point. So let me give you an example. Lloyd's of London, the insurance body, is responsible directly and indirectly for insuring 55% of the globe's fossil fuel projects. So that means a handful of people, the people you could fit on one double-decker bus, can make decisions which change the future of 55% of fossil fuel projects on the earth. That is blimmin' amazing. And actually, there's nothing to stop the 9,000 adults in Lynn to all getting onto that. It's just people don't know about it. There's individual action that we can take, which has got leverage way beyond changing one's dietary habits or stopping flying, which we should also do. But, you know, so actually, it's a hugely empowering when you realise what we can do as citizens. If we wake up, we can drive this change so much quicker.
Correct. So I'm just going to have a go at seeing whether this will play.
What would happen if we could hear the voice of humanity? Not just one part of it, or the loudest, but everyone. This November, the world's leaders will gather in Glasgow at COP26 to discuss the climate crisis. These talks have been taking place for 25 years. the world still getting hotter, meaning that many areas, millions of people, and even more plants and animals are already on the brink. How did this happen? Our leaders' hands are tied by a system built for an earlier age. Right now, we, the people, are ahead of the politicians. Across the world, citizens' assemblies are creating policies far more ambitious than anything politicians have come up with on their own. Politicians have to play the political game. We don't. We're free to understand the truth of what's really happening, listen to each other, and follow our conscience. It's up to us to light the way for politicians. That's why in 2021, we're going to run the first ever global citizens' assembly that anyone on earth can join. The heart of the assembly will be 1,000 people, a snapshot of the world's population broken down by gender, race, age, and economic background, chosen by lottery, meaning that anyone on earth, anyone, including you, could be selected. At the same time, anywhere in the world, people will be able to run their own events, which will be an integral part of the assembly, bringing in many more people. All participants will follow a thorough process to discuss the science, future possibilities, and vote on solutions. We are an extraordinary species, capable of doing extraordinary things. We can do this. We can change. Yes, 2020 has been a tough year, very tough. But it's also been a moment when many of us slowed down and heard the birds sing for the first time in years. So let's come together in 2021 and create the space for a new story to emerge, a story where we look after each other, a story where we listen carefully and the bird song doesn't fade, a story of hope. To do this, we need you to fund us. We need you to get involved. We need you to share your voice, your hopes and fears for the future, and get others to do the same. And when, for the first time, we hear the voice of humanity, there will be no going back.
Bob, do you want to say anything about that before we move on to summing up?
I agree with Zoe. I'd like to give Zoe credit for one thing that she did when she was the first chair of LIM Community Energy, and that was the extent to which the children in all four of our primary schools were infused by the fact that their schools were going to become driven by the sun and are going to be producing their own clean energy. And the teachers really stepped in and made sure that children not only understood the project, but went home, talked to their families about things that they could change, when started going around the houses, turning the lights off. Whether it lasted or not, I don't know. But in terms of investing in clean energy, it was the grandparents of those children who were queuing up to invest in what was both an educational and a sustainability project. So there are things that you can do. Again, a tiny drop in the ocean, but those are the ripples that go out. And I think that Zoe would like those to be massive waves. I think they need to be more than the small ripples, but I'm not quite sure that we can get a tsunami out there. So I think that getting that message out to citizens, and particularly through the coming generations, so as Zoe says, they're the ones who are going to be living with this or failing to live with this in the future. It's absolutely critical. And citizens' assemblies could certainly help with that.
Yeah, and I think as well, it's like Zoe says, she's been involved this for a long time. I have not, but there are so many things that when I thought about this that I have actually been involved in for a long time. And I think this is what most people will do when they hopefully listen to this podcast and it becomes a bit more top of mind for them, because the things that we know are, have we really been satisfied with the way the political agenda works for us locally and globally? No, I think most people will say no, but as individuals, have we done anything about that? You know, do we even know how our parish council works? And if we want something different, how we could support the getting the different? In the actions that are put here on this slide, how do we take responsibility for change? You know, a bit like we're saying, as your area declared a climate emergency, you know, find out what that means. And if you're shocked to find out it doesn't mean anything, then do something about that, because actually people will listen if you start making enough noise about it. And if you think the CEE bill is something that your MP should be supporting, then tell him. I actually wrote to Andy Carter to say, have you asked your constituents whether they want you to support this bill on their behalf? He has not responded to that. But I don't think, I think, and I'm first to put my hands up for this, we just do not challenge the people who represent us enough. If we want them to do something, they are there because we put them there. They are not there to decide whether this is good for us or not. They are there to do what we have decided it's good for us. And I think we need to really understand that. And it ties into what Zoe was saying about we can be the levers for change. Where our money goes, then this has always meant a lot to me. So I go around and I earn money, and then it's my decision where that money is spent. And that decision on where I spend my money is so important. And I think we've lost sight of that. It is that that keeps the capitalist structure alive. And we feel that we're trapped in a capitalist structure, yet actually all we have to do is stop spending our money in that way and it will collapse. We just don't see it as simply as that, but it is as simple as that. And I know, you know, going back to the system approach, there are lots of consequences of that happening, but those consequences are happening now. Job losses all over the place. They are happening now. So we could make this something more positive. Go, Zoe.
I love your energy, Nina, and thank you for creating this space, and thank you, Bob, as well. I mean, I got two or three quick things. I think we haven't really touched on the Global Assembly, but I find it a totally inspiring movement, the Global Assembly, and I really, really personally support it, as well as national and local citizens' assemblies. We need to hear the voices that aren't heard. We need to hear 50% of women. We need to hear the Global South. We need to hear the young. We need to hear the dispossessed, because they're all human and they're all part of us. We are one family. Just like the Pope says, just like Dalai Lama says, just like anyone who actually sees the bigger picture says, we're part of one species and we need to look after each other as well as all the other species. And it's, you know, it's not weird to say that anymore. And I'm so glad. I've thought this all my life, and I'm now not weird to say it, so I'm saying it. And I would also say, in terms of taking responsibility for change, absolutely engage in the CE Bill campaign, definitely engage in citizens' assemblies, engage in local politics. And I would also say, as you might expect me to, you know, engage in direct action, peaceful, non-violent direct action. We're having this conversation in part because the national conversation and the international conversation has shifted, and it's shifted in the last 2 years because of Greta and the school strikes and Extinction Rebellion. And Mother Nature is unwell and is showing us she's unwell. But if we hadn't have brought the conversation to the public awareness, yes, causing disruption, because you have to, because people don't stop the BAU until you disrupt it. And it's unfortunate, but that's what history has told us. You know, we know that from the suffragettes, from Gandhi, from poll tax strikes, everything that's happened in history that causes social change. That's why you and I have got the vote, Nina, isn't it? Because some women acted out and we misbehaved. So we have to misbehave to create change in a peaceful way, absolutely peaceful, but we have to misbehave to help people to realise this is really, really serious, because otherwise change doesn't happen, and that's what the social history tells us.
And Bob, last word for you.
Well, I'd like to endorse something that Nina said. It's something that I used to teach when I taught social policy, that getting a vote once every 4 or 5 years for a representative in an organisation that meets a few dozen times a year, even though it gets an enormous amount of publicity, is not really an effective way of affecting change. So if you are going to rely on local or national politics and the normal democratic process to get change, you're not going to get it. The way you get change is by every single time you spend any of your money, or when you invest your money, or when you say where you're happy to see your pension fund invested or not invested. Those are ways in which you can actually affect change every single day. And the other way in which you can affect change every single day, if you see the water running over the local grid because it's covered in leaves, push the leaves through and the water will go down the grid. It's not that hard. So it's those little things and those everyday actions which are actually much more important. And as a politician, I'm very happy to say, well, I'm not happy to say, but actually politicians are nowhere nearly as powerful as we'd like you to think we are.
You need us to help you to say the right thing and do the right thing. Yeah,
absolutely. Well,
so we need to get on the streets and help you, Bob.
Yeah. But thank you very much indeed for doing this podcast, Nina. Great fun.
Bob and Zoe, I'm so fortunate to have just come across the pair of you. And Bob, it was amazing. I tweeted you, I think. I think I've sent you a message on Twitter. The next day we were having a Zoom call. Then you introduced me to Zoe. I was out for a walk with her. I just want to show people as well that that is how easy it is. People are accessible. You two have been absolutely amazing. And I really, really want to thank you for taking part in this podcast and hope that there will be some more to come, because I think this is a conversation that we should continue.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Tina. Thanks, Bob. Take care.
Bye, everyone. Cheers. Thank you.
Thanks again to Nina's guests today, and thank you very much for listening to this episode of The Change Troubleshooter. Nina invites you to carry on the conversation with her directly. All contact details can be found on her website, ninadar.com. Join us for the next episode in 2 weeks' time. This has been a Sun-Soaked Creative production.